This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm Josh Hayes. I'm here with Sarah Leslie from the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy, and Sarah is going to tell us about some of her work. So, Sarah, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm an Australian studying for my PhD in Germany, and my research is on galaxy evolution, and one of my projects is measuring the star formation rate of galaxies across cosmic time, trying to understand how galaxies evolved over time, how they're forming their stars, how they're building up to become the galaxies that we see today. And the way we're doing this is using radio continuum emission from the JPLA.
Okay, so what do you mean by radio continuum?
So it's like radio emission that we're familiar with from our radios, but coming from space. And the reason why we want to use it is because it's at these such long wavelengths, so the emission can just travel through space without being interrupted by dust or anything along the way. And so we get this unobscured view of star formation. But one of the issues is that we still are trying to understand how this emission comes about and how we can exactly relate it to the number of stars that there are in a galaxy. And that's kind of what this conference that I'm at here in Manchester University is about. And so that's pretty exciting.
Okay, so what can the rate of star formation actually tell us about a galaxy?
Well, it tells us about what kind of galaxy it is and what its activity is. So understanding the rate of star formation is one of the key goals of current observational astrophysics. It helps us constrain models and as an input into simulations. So when we look at galaxies, what we're seeing is the light that's coming from the stars, mostly. So this is a really key quantity.
So what exactly can the star formation rate tell us about, say, the age of a galaxy? Is this something that we can look at and say there are more stars in one galaxy, mm-hmm. so this galaxy must be older or younger?
Yeah, so there's the star formation rate and then the stellar mass of the galaxy. So the star formation rate is what's happening right now, and the stellar mass is how many stars have been built up in the past. And what we find is that there's a really interesting correlation between a galaxy's star formation rate and the stellar mass. So they're proportional to each other for blue star-forming galaxies. So if you're thinking of like a spiral or like a disk galaxy, their stellar mass and star formation rate fall along a sequence. And we find that this exists at all redshifts. And this kind of implies that there's some kind of smooth process, like galaxies aren't just forming stars at a random rate. There's something like a smooth internal process that's driving this. But then we see some galaxies that are more red and dead. So they have higher stellar masses, but quite low star formation rates. So they've finished forming their stars. These are old, and we call them red and dead. And one of the things that I want to understand is how galaxies go from being these blue disks to being these red galaxies that are not forming stars anymore. So it's got something to do with the gas supply that they have and how they can convert their gas to stars. And maybe there's something that's stopping them from converting their gas to stars, like maybe there's an AGN, a jet that's heating up the gas or blowing all the gas away. So maybe there's no more gas anymore.
Okay, so we see blue galaxies through all ages of the universe. Do we see red galaxies today as well as way mm-hmm. back in the past? Are they present
yes.
at all times as well?
Yes, as far back as we can see, I think there seem to be galaxies that show some level of maturity. They've formed some stellar cores already, but the number of red galaxies was smaller in the past, so there wasn't so many galaxies that were as old. That makes sense, because when the universe was younger. But I think it's actually quite surprising there has been some recent discoveries of galaxies that are red at quite high redshifts, redshift 5 and so on. The reason why a galaxy appears red is the combination of a few things. It's the age of the stars, the age of the stellar population, but it's also tied to metallicity and also the amount of dust, because if there's dust, that also makes them reddening. So it's not straightforward to say this galaxy is red, so it's old, or it's only got the smaller stars remaining. But I just called them blue and red, because that's what people call them.
So a red and dead galaxy might not actually be a red and dead galaxy. A red galaxy could be a blue galaxy. Is that necessarily confusing?
Maybe that's unnecessary. I prefer to talk about them as more in terms of, are they disk dominated? Do they have a bulge that's a dominant component of the structure?
So what do you mean by disk dominated? Are you talking about structure?
Yeah, the structure of the stellar component. So are all the stars in a disk? And how thick is that disk? That's actually an interesting thing as well. So back at higher redshifts, people have been finding that the disks are more turbulent, and so the stars are at larger scale height, so the disks are more puffy than the flat spiral galaxies that we see today. And that could be because there was just more gas available to these galaxies at higher redshifts, so there's more gas coming around and things are more turbulent. Or it could be because the galaxies were forming stars more viciously and there was more supernova feedback, and so there was more turbulence because of that.
Is this then maybe some relation to elliptical galaxies and disk galaxies? Is this thought to maybe be a bridge between the two?
So we don't know how galaxies form their bulges, but we do see that galaxies that have a larger bulge, which is like a spherical component that's sitting in the center of the disk, we don't know how they're formed, but we do see that galaxies that have bulges have lower star formation rates. So they are in the process of dying and becoming these red elliptical galaxies. So I would think that these processes that drive the bulge growth are related to this quenching of the star formation. I think that's a pretty interesting thing that I would like to understand.
So we see more star formation in the disk of the galaxy than in the bulge.
Yes. So the bulge is made up of old stars, whereas the disk, it's got old stars, but it's also got new stars are being formed all the time.
Okay, so our Milky Way will eventually go on to become one of these elliptical red and dead galaxies?
It's possible, I think. Well, the Milky Way is going to merge with Andromeda, and then, well, one of the ways that elliptical galaxies could be made is from the mergers of two disks.
What impact would such a merger have on, say, the rate of star formation?
So when the merger happens, the gas gets funneled into the center of the system, and you get a big burst of star formation. And then, so this is kind of like the dramatic event that you see in merging galaxies and the beautiful images of ARC-220 and the antennae. And then eventually the star formation dies down, everything gets settled into a new stellar disk maybe, or an elliptical system. It depends on the angle that the two galaxies come at each other. And also the gas that gets funneled in, it also must be fueling the supermassive black holes that come from the original galaxies. And supermassive black holes must also merge eventually. This is all speculative, saying what probably happened. And there was some people from my previous group back in Australia were working on mergers. And there's this picture, so you have the starburst at the first pass of the two galaxies, and then you also are fueling an AGN, and then as the star formation dies down, the AGN is shining more brightly. So the older the merger stage, the more the AGN dominates the emission. And then eventually the gas is used up and the star formation stops, and you're left with perhaps a red and dead galaxy that's an elliptical. So that is one proposed mechanism of how we go from these disk galaxies to the red and dead ellipticals.
That's actually really interesting. I didn't know this. What exactly are you working on at the moment then? Mm-hmm. So what's your current focus?
So I actually work on many projects at once.
I'm sure many of our listeners will relate to that.
Yeah, but I guess the project that I'm working on at the moment is, as I said, using the radio continuum to measure the star formation rates of galaxies. But the low-mass galaxies, they're really faint, so it's hard to detect them in the images that we have. And so I am stacking images of galaxies that have the same stellar mass and same redshift, and to work out what their average radio emission is, and then to try and work out what their average star formation rate is. and then see how this changes over time and for galaxies of different mass. And to measure this main sequence relation is what we call it. I mentioned it already. It's the fact that the star formation rate and the stellar mass of galaxies are related. And to just constrain this better. And
so you've spoken about the fact that they are related, but what is the relation that we're looking at then?
So that's one thing that I'm trying to measure. So we know that they're correlated. So a galaxy with a high stellar mass is forming stars at a greater rate than a galaxy at low stellar mass. And here I'm talking about star-forming galaxies, so the ones that are blue and disk-like. Okay. And also, people have found that at higher redshifts, a galaxy that has, for the same stellar mass, the galaxies were forming stars at higher rate at higher redshift. And this is because there was more gas available to them. So they have higher gas fractions, higher star formation rates at higher redshift. So this correlation between star formation rate and stellar mass, some people find that it's close to linear. Some people find that it's got a turnover and it's shallower at higher masses and low redshift. So I'm just redoing the measurement and seeing how this depends on what type of galaxies we select, because we have to make a selection for these star-forming galaxies. And so whether we select via colors, like we're selecting blue galaxies or something else, and how that drives the correlations that we see. And these correlations are important to constrain because they're used as inputs or tests for our understanding of galaxy evolution. So all the cosmological simulations try to reproduce these results. So it's good to have good measurements of these results. And I find it really interesting because also this correlation was found 10 years ago and it's still quite new, and understanding it is, I think, would really help us understanding how galaxies form and evolve. Because at least 66% of the stars that have been formed in the universe were formed in a galaxy that was on this main sequence correlation.
So people have found that the relationship's been linear or that it's got a tail off. Is that from direct measurements or from simulations?
Right. So that's mostly from direct measurements. So the relationship is between star formation rate and stellar mass. So we have to measure star formation rate, and there's different ways of doing that. So the massive stars in galaxies is what we're measuring to measure the star formation rate, and these emit in the UV mostly, but the UV gets attenuated by dust. It gets absorbed and then re-emitted in the infrared. So some people use UV, some people use infrared, or what's better is a combination of the two, and that's what's been done in the past. But also, when these massive stars die, they explode as supernovae, and these supernovae accelerate electrons, and these electrons then emit synchrotron emission as they gyrate around magnetic fields. And this synchrotron emission, we can pick it up in the radio. So what I'm measuring for my PhD is an independent measurement of the number of massive stars in the galaxy.
So you're somehow measuring star formation rate from
the number
supernovae.
Of supernovae, yes.
How do you relate the number of stars dying to the number of stars mm-hmm. being formed?
It's all dependent on what time scale you're referring to. So while the stars are still alive, they're still emitting in the UV. But then the UV heats the dust, and it takes a bit of time for the dust to then re-radiate in the infrared. And so when we talk about star formation rate, we're talking about on particular time scales. So the radio is sensitive to star formation that happened about 10 mega years ago, because that's how long it takes for the massive stars to go supernovae. Whereas if you're measuring H alpha, that time scale is less than 10 mega years ago. And so this is something that is often brushed over, but it's relevant. So we're measuring the flux that we get, and then we convert to luminosity because we know the distance to the galaxies from their redshift, but, and then we have to assume we know how to relate the flux to the number of stars that made that flux. And so we rely on a lot of stellar models, models of what the stars are emitting. And we're not just measuring one star at a time because these galaxies are far away. We can't resolve individual stars. So we have to have models of the stellar population. So we have massive stars, intermediate mass stars, low mass stars, and...
And so I'm assuming you sort of take your measurements of the galaxy and try and fit those sort of high, low, medium mass star parameters mm-hmm. to recreate that output?
Yes, but to do that, you need to have observations at many different wavelengths, or spectra, I guess. So in my work, I'm using the Cosmos Survey, so that's a 2-square-degree field in the sky that's been observed by all the major observatories, so it has multi-wavelength photometry from X-rays all the way to radio. So it's a large international collaboration that's about 100 or more different members, and it's been a large effort to get all these observations so that we can measure things like the stellar mass of these galaxies based on the stellar population.
So you're now in this position to actually start making these much larger scale measurements across many different wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you hoping to actually see this work go in the future?
So I guess it's kind of an incremental process. We do the best with what we can at each stage. So whenever we get a new data set, we add it and we remake all our measurements, and we can go deeper or to further redshift. So in the future, you know, we'll be making these kind of measurements for galaxies that were at the beginning of the universe. So when the universe was younger and younger. And the great thing about astronomy is that we can have this time axis. By looking further away, we're looking further back in time, and we can actually look at how galaxies evolved. So in the future, so we're going to add more wavelengths so that we can constrain more properties of the galaxies and get deeper observations so that we can look at fainter galaxies, which either have a lower stellar mass, so they're fainter, they have less stars, or they're further away.
Sarah, thank you very much for allowing us to interview you.
Thanks for having me.
That's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.